I think every one of us in here do realize Jesus is watching us. He's planning and preparing us for jobs in his coming kingdom. So hopefully that wasn't sacrilegious, but Jesus is watching us. And remember his words, Hebrews 13:5, I will never leave you or forsake you. We can also cite various Old Testament scriptures. Genesis 28:15, if you'd turn there. Genesis 28:15, he says, and behold, I am with you, and will keep you in all the places where you go, and will bring you again into this land. For I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken of to you. So the God of the Old Testament was watching over him. And then Moses instructed Joshua in the same manner. Deuteronomy 31:6. Deuteronomy 31:6. Be strong and of good courage. Fear not, nor be afraid of the enemy, for the Lord your God goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. And he repeats it again in verse 8. Samuel warned the people in 1 Samuel 12:22. 1 Samuel 12:22. For the Lord will not forsake his people for his great name's sake. And we heard about having the name of God that we needed to honor in the sermon yesterday. David told his son Solomon, 1 Chronicles 28:20, God will not fail you or forsake you until you have finished all the work for the service of the house of God. And then to get some New Testament verification, Matthew 28:20, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I've commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So we see the writings down through the years, down through the centuries. God isn't forsaking his people. And we're told in Malachi 3:6, for I am the Lord, I change not. So we know that's possible today. But how can this be? How can it be that Jesus Christ can watch us and know what we're doing and all of that? Let's look at Psalm 139. Psalm 139, starting in verse 1. O Eternal, you have searched me and known me. You know my down-sitting and my up-rising. Understand my thoughts afar off. You compass my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, O Lord, that thou knowest altogether. Now that's a scary thought. Sometimes we heard Mr. Ledbetter talking about some things, you know. We want to be careful what we even think, because Almighty God knows it ahead of our saying it. Verse 5, you have beset me behind and before and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high, I cannot attain to it. Where should I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend up to the heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in the grave, behold, you are there. He's everywhere. He knows us. He knows us intimately. Take a look at Jeremiah 1. Jeremiah 1, starting in verse 5. Jeremiah 1, verse 5. God says, before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. And before you came forth out of the womb, I sanctified you, ordained you a prophet unto the nations. Then said I, Ah, Lord, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child. But the Eternal said unto me, Say not, I am a child, for you shall go to all that I send you, and whatsoever I command you shall speak. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Eternal. Now, we know there are several in the Bible that God specifically says he knew them before they were born. John the Baptist, and there's others. So whether exactly he knew us all intimately before we were born? I think that's certainly a possibility. So he does know us. Jesus knows us intimately and watches over us, just like that Rottweiler was watching that thug. And all of this shows us that we serve a God that's not haphazard, not helter-skelter, but he has our lives mapped out in the minutest ways when we stop to think about it. So much so that if we stay in faith, if we obey God, if we meet his conditions, he can bring circumstances in our lives to bring the right people to the right place at the right time to help us. Have you ever heard the expression, "I guess I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time"? You've seen a detective story where some guy gets arrested and sent to jail because he was just someplace where a crime had just been committed. Well, there is a true story, and this happened maybe 35 years ago in Boston. A man was jogging near his apartment complex, and he happened to be dressed in about the same size as the man who had just robbed a convenience store and shot the clerk. And as he was jogging along, the police car saw him. They turned on their lights. They pulled him over. They arrested him. And he was convicted. And he spent, if I'm not mistaken, several years in jail until DNA information came out that proved him innocent. He sued the city of Boston. And I checked on it like 10 years later. And to that point, they had never paid up. But he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And life can do that to us, can it? I remember when I was about 10 or 11 years old, we rented a house from a very elderly couple, the Parkers. No relations. I mean, they were elderly. I had never seen the man. We were in the front part of the house. They had the back apartment. And Mrs. Parker walked all humped over, and we tried to be respectful of their age and be quiet during certain hours. But I was playing with a neighbor girl. She was about 3 years older than I was. And we're out making snowballs. And we're throwing snowballs back and forth. And all of a sudden, she got the wild idea to slam a big snowball in the back door of the Parker's apartment. She took off running. I didn't think I'd get in any problem because I didn't do anything. But I was wrong. So Mrs. Parker, I could see her in the window. She came to the door and she says, "Tommy Coover, I'm going to tell your mother what you're doing." But I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, as we honor God, follow Jesus Christ as our example in our lives and everything we do, his divine plan will unfold for us, and the right people will show up at the right times in our life. And when I use the term people, let's change it in our minds to entities. It could be an angel. It could be an animal. It seems just before the spring holidays and before the Feast of Tabernacles, sometimes Satan and his demons try to make everything very difficult for us. They try to disable us, hurt us, discourage us. They do everything they can to try to disrupt us from keeping the Feast of Tabernacles and obeying his festivals. Now, maybe some of you or all of you came through with flying colors. No problems, no illnesses, no deterrence, no car problems. Well, good on you. I'm glad. That's what we hope for. That's what we pray for. But from time to time, people have these problems. So I can give you some firsthand examples, if you'll bear with me, and things that have actually happened to us personally, my wife and I, to illustrate how God can put the right people in the right place at the right time. One wintry night in northwestern Pennsylvania, it was about 9 o'clock. We were heading home from a church visit. I was with the minister, and we were riding on these narrow, curvy mountain roads in Pennsylvania. One side was hillside right up, forested. The other side was valley, forest along the side there. We traveled for 20 minutes, and there wasn't a light of a house anywhere. There was no driveways. There was no crossroads. We're just driving on this narrow, there was barely enough road to pass two cars, okay? As we're driving along, I heard the minister go, "Oh no." And I looked in the rearview mirror. Here's a state trooper, had his lights on. My buddy pulled over. Trooper pulled over about 40 yards behind. Come up, tapped on the window. License, registration. He flipped open his license, and his habit was to have his ministerial certificate right next to where the license would show. And that made me pause because I guess he was just planning on getting picked up more often than I would have thought. However, when the policeman saw the license, he said, "Well, Pastor so-and-so, I'm going to warn you. The roads are treacherous out here. You need to slow down a little bit." And he stepped back. Minister put the window up. Before that window got halfway up, I'm looking in the back mirror. There was no car and lights. There was no policeman. There was absolutely nowhere to turn around. He wasn't there. I nudged the minister and I said, "I think we just had an angel warn us." The hair stood up on the back of both of our necks at that point in time. Now, the interesting part about this story is about 2 months ago, we had visitors come to the church in Corpus. And somebody was talking about miracles that had happened to him. So I brought this story up. And the guy I was talking to started to smirk. And I'm thinking, okay, he doesn't believe me. I really thought that's, so when I finished, I said, "What's going on?" He says, "You won't believe this, but 2 weeks ago, I heard that exact same story from the guy who was driving the car, and he was pretty sure it was an angel too." So I thought, boy, I hope the stories kind of jive. I could go on with stories about me. You've got to think about your life. Where and when has God performed an absolute miracle in your life? Something that you cannot explain any other way. You may have heard, and this is a story that circulated quite a long time ago. The young lady who was working in the mid-city, and I can't even remember where it was, but she was in one of the upper floors. She was working late. She had to walk two blocks to where her car was parked. And as she hit the street, started walking, three or four thugs came up to her. They tried to grab her purse. One was jostling her, they're trying to frisk her. And she screamed out. And the men started running away. And as they ran around the corner, they ran into two policemen that were on the beat right then and there. And the policemen were talking to them. And the lady caught up with the police. And the policeman says, Why did you run away? He asked the lady, did he hurt you? Did he? No, they just got fresh with me, but I'm okay. They didn't get my purse or anything. And so he looked at the men. He says, "Why did you run away?" He said, "We weren't going to tangle with those four guys behind us." They put him in. They put the thugs in the police car, and the other cop was asking the lady some more details. She says, "When I turned around and screamed, there was absolutely nobody there. God put somebody in the right place at the right time to protect her." And you know, these things happen to other people too. God will be merciful to whom God will be merciful. So that was one of those things. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 6. 2 Kings chapter 6, starting in verse 11. "Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was troubled." If you remember at this point, Syria was at war with Israel. And every time the Syrian king would lay out plans and have his generals go to trap Israel or something, Israel would be a step ahead of him. And the king was getting pretty frustrated. And it says, "Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was troubled for this thing. And he called his servants and said unto them, 'Will you not show me which one of us is for the king of Israel? Who's the turncoat here? Who's the traitor? I can't catch them because they're always a step ahead of us.' One of his servants said, 'None, my lord. But Elisha, the prophet that's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedchamber. So the secrets that the king is telling, Elisha understands God is revealing it to him. So he tells the king of Israel. So the king of Syria said, go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, behold, he's in Dothan. Therefore he sent there horses and chariots and a great host. And they came by night and encompassed the city about. And when the servant of the man of God was risen early in the morning, he went forth, and behold, a host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And his servant said unto him, alas, master, what are we going to do? And Elisha answered him and said, those that be with us are more than they that be with them. And I could just see the servant going, there's two of us, and there's all of them. So what did Elisha do? Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray you open this man's eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about. God put those people in that place to protect the prophet that he had had doing his work. So he did for Elisha basically what he did for that lady on the street. He put somebody there that really wasn't there. There was a lady I knew in the church, and this is going back 30 years probably. She had a very rough life. She had been divorced from a very abusive man. She had to work two jobs sometimes just to make ends meet. She was a serving lady. She was a very committed, convicted lady in the church. And one afternoon, she had volunteered to help a friend to take her home from the hospital after she had her rehabilitation from a surgery. And she was waiting quite a while in the afternoon at the waiting room. And all of a sudden, this elderly gentleman came in. And he sat down next to her. And he said, you mind if I sit here? And she said, no. And she smiled, and just they picked up a conversation. And they talked and talked and talked. She said they spent all the whole time until she was called to take her friend home. And just as the nurse came out and said, so-and-so, we're ready, you can go pick her up at the desk, the old gentleman held her arm and said, wait 1 minute. There's something I'd like to give you. He reached in his pocket. There were two little boxes. He said, I'm 93 years old. I've outlived two wives. I don't have one relative that I can give these to. And he gave her two diamond engagement rings and two diamond wedding bands. God put him in the right place at the right time for her, certainly, didn't he? You might say, that is just absurd. God doesn't manipulate people like that and put them around like a puppet on a string. I just don't believe it. Take a look at Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, verse 12. Mark 14, verse 12, in the middle says, where will you that we go and prepare that you may eat the Passover? The disciples were asking Christ. And he sent forth two of his disciples and said to them, go into the city, and there you will find a man bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him. And wheresoever he shall go, and say to the good man of the house, Master, ask, where is the guest chamber where I can eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished, and there make ready for us. So what happened? Did they get there and look all over the city and couldn't find a man with a pitcher of water? It says in verse 16, and his disciples went forth, came into the city, found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. So how did they get there? God knew they would be there, and he prepared the circumstances just before that so they would be there. Think about Acts 9, 10 through 18. The Apostle Paul, before he was the Apostle, was blinded on the road to Damascus. And while he was blinded and needed help to even get around, God put it in his heart to check out a certain place where Ananias would be. And at the same time, he was giving a vision to Ananias that Paul of Tarsus was going to come and want to be healed. And Ananias says, no. I've heard about that dude. He's wreaking havoc. And now he's even got papers that he can arrest anybody that believes in that way. So what happened? Paul showed up. Ananias laid hands on him, and he was healed. I want to read a story because it'll cover what I'm trying to talk about here pretty succinctly. This lady writes this article. My dad had been a lumberjack. He entered grueling lumberjack competitions over the years, and the shelves of his house were filled with trophies that attested to the prowess that he once had in his younger days. Years marched on relentlessly. The first time he couldn't lift a heavy log, he joked about it, but later I saw him in the backyard straining to pick it up. And he became irritable when anybody would talk to him about his advancing age. At 67, he had a massive heart attack. He was lucky. He survived. But she writes, something inside Dad died. His zest for life was gone. He became an old curmudgeon. He was mean, and he just created problems. Offers from people to help him were turned around and turned away with sarcasm, and the number of friends finally diminished. And he was basically alone. She writes, my husband, Richard, and I asked Dad to come live with us on our small farm. We hoped the fresh air and the rustic atmosphere would help him adjust. Within a week, I regretted that we asked him to come with us. He criticized everything we did. Nothing made him happy. He was just miserable, and he was making us miserable. She writes, I became frustrated and moody, alarmed. My husband set up weekly counseling appointments for us. At the close of each session, we prayed, asking that God would soothe Dad's troubled mind. Months wore on, and it seemed God was silent. We didn't get any answers. Something had to be done, and she knew that it had to depend upon her. So the next day, she sat down with a phone book and called each of the mental health clinics in the area. She explained to each one of them the situation with her dad. With no help, nothing seemed to help, and she was just ready to give up. She made up her mind, I'm going to make one more call. So she asked this lady, she went through the situation, and the lady said, I'm glad you called. I have just finished a study that was about depressed patients who improved dramatically when they were given the responsibility of a dog. So that afternoon, she drove to the animal shelter. Each pen contained several dogs, and she said, as I neared the last pen in the shadows of the far corner, struggled to his feet this old, thin pointer. His hips were in lopsided triangles, his mustache was gray, and he was a pointer, but he was just a caricature of the breed. Years had etched his face, his hip bones jutted lopsided. But she said it was his eyes that caught her attention. His eyes. They were calm, clear, and they caught her attention. They beheld me unwaveringly, she said. I pointed to that dog. The kennel officer shook his head. He said, that's a strange one. He appeared out of nowhere and sat in front of the gate. And we thought for sure he was from close by and somebody would be by soon to retrieve him. He said, he's been here for 2 weeks and his day is up tomorrow. And she said, you're going to kill him? Ma'am, we don't have room for every unclaimed dog. She said, I looked at that pointer again. The calm, brown eyes awaited my decision. I'll take him, she said. I drove home with my dog on the front seat beside me. When I reached the house, I honked the horn twice. I was helping my prize out of the car when Dad shuffled out onto the porch. Look what I got for you, Dad. If I'd wanted a dog, I would have gotten myself a dog. And I would have gotten better than that bag of bones. She said, Dad, you better get used to it because he's staying. We stood glaring at each other like duelists, she said, when suddenly the pointer pulled away from my hand. He wobbled toward my dad, sat down in front of him, and carefully raised his paw. Dad's lower jaw trembled as he stared at the uplifted paw. Confusion replaced the anger in his eyes. The pointer just waited patiently. And then before we knew it, Dad was on his knees hugging the dog. It was the beginning of a warm and intimate friendship. Dad named the pointer Cheyenne. And together, Dad and Cheyenne spent long hours walking down the dusty lanes. They spent times angling at the streams for tasty trout. They even started attending church together with us. Dad in the seat, Cheyenne there at his feet. Dad's bitterness faded. He and Cheyenne made many, many friends. His attitude was totally changed. And she said, then late one night, I was startled to feel Cheyenne's cold nose boring through our blankets. He had never come before into our bedroom at night. I woke up my husband, put on my robe, ran into my father's room. Dad lay in his bed, his face serene, but sometime during the night, his spirit quietly left him. 2 days later, she writes, my shock and grief deepened when I discovered Cheyenne laying dead beside Dad's bed. I wrapped his still form in the rag that he had slept on. As my husband and I buried him near a favorite fishing hole, I silently thanked God for that dog that had made such a difference in my dad's life, restoring his peace of mind. In the morning of Dad's funeral, it dawned overcast and dreary, and she said, it looks like the way I feel. As I walked down the aisle through to the pews reserved for the family, I was surprised to see the many, many friends that came to pay honor to my dad and Cheyenne, filling the church. The pastor began his tribute, both to Dad and the dog that had changed his life, and he turned to Hebrews 13:2. And it said, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. And then she writes, for me, the past dropped into place, completing a puzzle that I hadn't completely thought of before. The sympathetic voice that had just read the article, the dog that just happened to show up at the kennel, Cheyenne's unexpected devotion and complete acceptance of her father, and then the proximity of their deaths. She said, God had answered my prayers after all. God put the right people to help that lady, then the dog at the right place at the right time to help Dad. What I'm trying to drive home is God is watching us. He can do these things for us. Hearing other people's stories might wow us a little bit, but a lot of times we figured, well, nothing like that ever happened to me. But it's in Scripture, and it has happened to people. Remember the Shunammite woman who took in Elisha? He wanted to return favor, so what did he do? She wanted a son. He prayed, and she had a son. And then he fell. What am I? I'm not on here. Can you hear me? How about now? If I can hear me, you can hear me. He wanted to do her a favor. Then he fell. The kid fell, hit his head, and died. Elisha prayed, and the son was restored to life. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 8. 2 Kings chapter 8. I'm often telling the congregation in Corpus, because we Zoom and we're using the internet a lot, and I'm always amazed at how wonderful the technology is. And I said, this is absolutely great technology until it isn't. And then we're in the dark. 2 Kings 8, starting in verse 1. Then spoke Elisha unto the woman, whose son he had restored to life, saying, Arise, go, and you and your household, and sojourn wheresoever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine on the land, and it shall come on the land for 7 years. So here he's giving her a heads up. God's told him there's going to be a famine. She's not going to survive where she is. She needs to move. She needs to get where there was no famine. Verse 2, and the woman arose, followed the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines for the 7 years. It came to pass at the 7 years' end that the woman returned out of the land of the Philistine, and she went forth to cry unto the king for her house and her land. So 7 years she's gone. The weeds are growing up around the house. People go by there and say, hey, somebody's abandoned this place. We're going to move in. So somebody settled on her property, used her crops, lived in her house, and she wanted some retribution. She wanted to talk to the king and see if she couldn't get her land back. After the king, at the same time, is talking, well, after he had talked to Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, tell me, I pray you, of all the great things that Elisha has done. Coincidence here. And it came to pass, as he was telling the king how he had restored a dead body to life, that behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life cried to the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi said, my lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is the son that he brought back from the dead. And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed unto her a certain official, saying, restore all that was hers and all the fruits of the field since the day that she had left her land, even till now. So she had done good for Elisha, and God saw to it that Gehazi was there, right person, right place, the right time, so this lady could get her land back. He was the right person. God repeatedly has done this for people down through the ages. I talked to a man in North Central Texas who had been a member for quite a number of years, and he admitted he was backsliding. He talked that he had started abusing his wife, starting to drink, using some drugs. He realized that he was a mess, and he was about ready to take his life. The phone rang, and it shocked him. It was his pastor. He talked to his pastor every Sabbath, and his pastor never had reason to call him, and he just happened to pick up the phone to call him to find out how he was doing. They talked quite a while. The pastor encouraged him, and when he was relaying this to me a year or so later, tears just came to his eyes, and he says he was certainly at the right place at the right time. Coincidence? I really don't believe in coincidences. I think there's a great God in heaven that takes care of us in those ways. At church one time, I was talking to a couple people, and they were mentioning that some miraculous thing happened. And as I looked around, I'm getting, you know, people are looking at this lady like she's crazy. And I told us a couple stories that truly happened to us. And a lady came to me afterwards, and she said, you know, I have a story that I've never dared tell anybody because I didn't think anybody would believe me. And I said, well, let me hear it. They lived in the coast area, and their property was right up next to the road, and only the narrow road going by, and then a couple feet in a drop-off, rocks in the water. She was out in the yard. This is going back 35 years ago, because her son now was 38, 40 by the time she was telling me this story. She said, my son was playing outside, about 3 years old, I guess, worked the latch on the gate and got out. And he was running across the road, and he soon would have been in peril. A car came up, slammed on its brakes. A man got out, picked up the little boy, put him over the fence. And by the time she stood up to thank him, there was nobody there. Long street both ways, didn't go either way. There was nobody there. And she repeated, I've never dared tell anybody that because they think I'm crazy. Another story. When we moved to San Antonio from Buffalo, New York, I moved down about 3 months before my wife. Well, I didn't move down. I come down and stayed with a friend that was in northwestern Pennsylvania, driving on that night when we got warmed. And I was living with them for 3 months looking for work, and I was finding work. And it left it up to my wife to sell the goods in the house and try to get the house sold. One night she called me and told me this story. A lot of people were in, looking at this, looking at that, buying this, buying that, taking this, taking that. One man kind of wandered off, got kind of out of bounds, and he's opened the garage door, and he says, hey, what do you want for the boat? Kind of shocked my wife, because she hadn't advertised the boat, and nobody had seen the boat. And she says, I think my husband wants to take it with him when we move. He says, well, why don't you ask him? So she calls. I said, listen, we had good use of that boat for 3 years. I bought it secondhand. It was in perfect shape. I said, if we can get for it what I paid for it, go ahead and sell it. So she went back and told the man. He says, well, that seems fair. I'll buy the boat, but I want to take it out on the lake. We were about a mile from Lake Erie. It's late at night. My wife said, I'm sorry. I just can't let you do that. I'm not going to go with you down on the lake, and I can't let you just take it. And he said, well, I'd be foolish to buy a boat and pay that much money for it if I didn't get to try it out. Pam says, all I can tell you is it worked the last time we used it, and we use it, you know, often. And he started fussing, and he walked out in a huff. Well, she figured, there's that. Not going to sell the boat tonight. Next night, or a couple nights later, the guy came back. He says, I really want that boat, but you got to understand, I'm a businessman, and this isn't good business to just buy something sight unseen. I need to take it out and make sure it works. And Pam says, I'm sorry, but this is the final thing. I can't let you do it. And she turned around, and there's two men standing in her kitchen. We had a heavy front door. She didn't hear the door. She said, I'm sorry, can I help you? We're here to buy the boat. I beg your pardon? I haven't advertised the boat. The only person that knew about the boat was the guy that was bidding on it. He didn't want to tell anybody, so we know he didn't let it out. She says, I'm sorry, what? We're here to buy the boat. The other man that was there first said, no. I'm here first. He wrote the check out for the boat and bought it, and Pam turned around, and they weren't there. We had a long driveway. Pam raced through the hallway, looked out the door. Nobody in the driveway. No car. She even went out to the end of the driveway and looked up and down the road. There was no car leaving. Coincidence? I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, you're probably tired of hearing stories, but I'm going to tell you one more. Years ago, and this is going back about 15 years, I would go up a couple weeks when it's hot in the summer down here in Texas and work with my son, whom I trained to be a painter from the time he was 10 years old. He had a good going business up there. We'd go up there for a couple weeks. Then he'd come down in the winter a couple weeks sometimes. So we were there. One day we headed out. We were going to go work along on a big cottage along Cuca Lake. Central New York. We're driving out as a highway, not a, like an interstate, but it was a state highway, Route 54A. And as we drove up to the place where we were going to turn off, there was a nice area to park and turn around between the road we were on and the road we were going to turn on. There's this turtle in the lane coming this way, right ahead of us. I said, Tim, pull over. I'll grab that turtle and put it in the back of the pickup, and you can take it home to the in your pond for Jake. He'd love to have that turtle he can see from time to time. He said, sure. He pulled over. I went out, looked, bent over to pick up that turtle, and something picked me up and set me back about 3 feet. And a car straddled that turtle going about 60, 65 miles an hour. Big old brown Oldsmobile. I caught that. I went back, composed myself, took a deep breath, put the turtle in the back of the truck, got in. My son started the key, started out on the road back to finish our trip. I said, did anybody see what just happened? Tim says, see what happened. I just about saw my dad splattered all over Route 54A until something picked him up and set him about 3 feet back. How'd that happen? God puts, he had an angel there at the right place at the right time, or I wouldn't be here. So these things happen. Why does God put right people in the right place at the right time? Let's take a look at John chapter 6. I'm having so much fun here, I forgot what time it was. John chapter 6, starting in verse 5. Jesus was out preaching, the multitudes came up. Verse 5, when Jesus then lifted up his eyes, saw a great company come unto him, he said unto Philip, when shall we buy bread that these may eat? So where are you going to go get some bread? And this he said to prove him, because he knew what he was already going to do. Verse 7, Philip answered him, 200 penny worth of bread is still not sufficient for them, that every one of them may even just take a little. Then one of the disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, there's a lad here. He has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but they're not enough among so many. Verse 10, and Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in that place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. So if half of them brought their wives and children, you know, there could be 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people there. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to the people that were sat down. Likewise, the fishes, as much as they would. When they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Think of that story. Jesus sees the multitude. There's a boy with very little. He manufactures more, okay? Who is the boy? We don't know. Who are his parents? It doesn't say. All we know is he had loaves and fishes. Was he a peddler that figured he could make a buck off the people there on the knoll? Did one of the disciples say, hey, bring enough stuff just for us? We don't know. It doesn't say. But God put the right person, that lad, in the right place, the grassy hillside, at the right time. Turn to Jeremiah 29, if you would. Jeremiah chapter 29. Verse 11. Jeremiah 29, verse 11. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Eternal, thoughts of peace, not of evil, to give you an expected end. Then you shall call upon me, and you shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you. Sort of a end times message. Why does God do these things for us? To make us think we have a genie in the bottle, you know, I need something done, and it gets done. No, he has reasons. You know, we can learn from hearing these stories. We can understand that God does things for us. And you're probably thinking to yourself, what's this got to do with the Feast of Tabernacles and the millennium? I'm glad you asked. If you think of Isaiah 11:9, you write that down, Habakkuk 2:14, in the end time, during this time that we're picturing here today, the earth is going to be filled with the knowledge of God like the waters cover the sea. Now, again, is God going to, and that just happens? What do we understand from reading the Bible from Genesis through Revelation? That when God does things, most often he's using people to either initiate it or to do it. Did God just blink and have the Israelites understand the Ten Commandments? No. He sent Moses up the mountainside to get them. God uses people. When he said at end time, preach the gospel to the entirety of the world, and then will the end come, did he blink and make everybody understand it? No. He started a work. Brethren, you and I are going to have a part of that. You and I are going to have a part of that. Turn to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah chapter 30. Starting in verse 17. No, starting in verse 18 here. And therefore will the Lord wait, that he may be gracious unto you. And therefore he will be exalted, that he may have mercy upon you. For the Lord is a God of judgment. Blessed are all they that wait on him. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious unto you at the voice of thy cry, and he will hear it, and he will answer thee. And though the Lord give you the water of affliction, yet he shall, the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner any more, but your eyes will see your teachers. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it, when you turn to the right hand, when you turn to the left. Brethren, you and I are going to be those people that are going to be there to help the people that have come out of the worst devastation, chaotic catastrophe that has ever happened to this planet. And we're going to be there, and we're going to be the right people in the right place at the right time.